Hi, this is Brian, and we are reading The Hill for Tuesday, April 7. The story, GOP patience with Iran operation growing thinner as Trump escalates tensions. Some Republican lawmakers are growing wary about the military conflict in Iran, which has entered its sixth week and could escalate further after President Trump urged Tehran to reopen the Strait of Hormuz or face all hell. The Iran operation is unfolding at a politically precarious moment for Republicans as the midterm election season ramps up and segments of the MAGA base grow increasingly restless over a perceived drift away from the America First agenda. While Trump initially projected the operation would only last for 4 to 5 weeks, he has since escalated tensions, most notably by threatening strikes on Iran's infrastructure over the weekend, and hasn't ruled out U.S. boots on the ground, moves that risk a longer, more entangled conflict. GOP lawmakers were almost in lockstep behind Trump when he launched the strikes in February, but some now say they want Congress to step in and assert its authority if the conflict extends beyond 60 days. Constitutional limits are in place to temper the president from unilateral authority. I support the president's actions taken in defense of American lives and interests. However, I will not support ongoing military action beyond a 60-day window. Without congressional approval, Senator John Curtis, Republican of Utah, wrote in an op-ed for Deseret News on April 1, adding that the War Powers Resolution of 1973 limits the president's period of time to respond to emerging threats. A 60-day period is fully sufficient window for presidents to take emergency measures in response to a national threat and then remit a decision to the duly elected representatives of the people as to whether a state of war should be in fact be declared and continued, Curtis wrote. Representative Don Bacon, Republican of Nebraska, told The Hill on Monday that he'd consider a vote on a war powers resolution if the conflict extends past 60 days. I do think Iran has been a threat for 47 years, and they've killed roughly 1,000 Americans, but I'd consider the resolution, he said. He added that he hopes the conflict is short, but that the enemy has a vote. If the regime wants to wage war, then it will go longer. I hope the regime decides for quick peace. We've delivered outstanding results in a month. We all prefer a quick ending, he said. Representative Mike Lawler, Republican of New York, who's running for re-election in a competitive district, told NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday that Congress will have to take necessary action if the conflict goes beyond the 60-day window. He added, and I would support that. Trump on Monday doubled down on his weekend threat to go after Iranian infrastructure, warning that all of Iran could be taken out in one night if the country's leaders don't make a deal by 8 p.m. Tuesday to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, through which roughly 20% of the world's oil supply passes. We've given them until tomorrow at 8 o'clock, and after that they're going to have no bridges, no power plants, Trump told reporters at a White House news conference, saying again that Iran would be sent back to the Stone Ages. The Iranian government wrote on social platform X earlier Monday that it rejected a 15-point peace proposal from the U.S., calling it unrealistic, and adding that it refuses any negotiations conducted under the shadow of illegal sanctions, military threats, or coercion. Iran had sent over a 10-point response to end the war, Axios reported, but Trump told reporters on Monday that while Iran's proposal was significant, it still wasn't good enough. A number of Republicans are still standing behind Trump in the conflict. I know the president is really frustrated, and we do want to see the straits open. It's not just good for the United States, but it's good for Europe and so many other countries, Senator Joni Ernst, Republican of Iowa, told reporters Monday. Still, a majority of Americans aren't happy with the ongoing operation. In a CNN poll released last week before Trump gave an address on the conflict, 66% of respondents said they either somewhat disapprove or strongly disapprove of the U.S. decision to take military action in Iran. The frustrations over the conflict have been mounting across the GOP conference. Representative Lauren Boebert, Republican of Colorado, said last month that she wouldn't back an Iran supplemental funding package with the Pentagon floating a $2 billion price tag. I've already told leadership I am a no on any war supplementals, Boebert told CNN's Manu Raju. I am so tired of spending money elsewhere. I am tired of the industrial war complex getting all of our hard-earned tax dollars. I have folks in Colorado who can't afford to live. Representative Nancy Mace, Republican of South Carolina, has previously said on X that she will not support troops on the ground in Iran. And the House Armed Services Committee Chair Mike Rogers, Republican of Alabama, criticized the Trump administration last month for not providing enough answers about the operation during a briefing. Representatives Thomas Massie, Republican of Kentucky, and Ro Khanna, Democrat of California, brought a war powers resolution on Iran to the House floor less than a week after Trump joined Israeli leaders in launching massive strikes against Iran in late February. It failed by a vote of 212 to 219, with four Democrats bucking their party to oppose it. Representatives Greg Landesman of Ohio, Jared Golden of Maine, Henry Cuellar of Texas, and Juan Vargas of California. House Democratic leaders are aiming to bring another war powers resolution to the floor after lawmakers returned from a two-week spring recess, and this time some centrists appear to be shifting in their support. Landesman, Cuellar, and Vargas are all poised to back the measure. It is unclear how many Republicans will back the measure if it comes to the floor. Massie is expected to be a yes, but it remains uncertain whether Representative Warren Davidson, Republican of Ohio, who supported the War Powers Resolution previously, will do so again. Mace told CNN earlier this month that she was concerned about escalation in the operation against Iran. If there's going to be conventional troops on the ground, a mainland invasion, for example, this is a different phase of the war or conflict that we would be entering into, and Congress needs to be briefed, she said. Congress needs to have a say. She added, I'm concerned about loss of life and casualty projections, potentially for ground troops, etc., and Congress should be briefed on that before any action is taken. Senate Republicans had also blocked a war powers resolution last month, with Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky being the only member of his party to break ranks and support it. The story: Rahm Emanuel makes case for change to a divided Democratic Party. Rahm Emanuel helped build the modern Democratic Party. Now he's making the case that it isn't working. In recent months, as he tests the waters for a 2028 presidential bid, the one-time chief of staff to former President Obama has emerged as one of the party's most pointed internal critics, warning that Democrats are losing their bearings on issues ranging from economic messaging to cultural positioning. Democrats lost the plot, Emanuel said last month on the podcast The Fifth Column, adding that the party got unanchored. Every one of our most successful electoral presidents anchored themselves in what I call middle-class values and values that are universal, at least in this country, ascribed to. We went from acceptance to advocacy, said Emanuel, a former Chicago mayor who has at times tangled with progressives in the party. Big difference, added Emanuel, who most recently served as former President Biden's ambassador to Japan. Emanuel's remarks are getting outsized attention, in part because they come in a midterm election year from the architect of his party's successful effort to retake the House in 2006. At the time, Emanuel recruited a number of centrist candidates to win races in purple districts, including Heath Shuler, the former NFL quarterback who won a seat in North Carolina. Much of Emanuel's message that year involved middle-class economic issues at a time when the Iraq War was the big focus. 20 years later, another war in the Middle East has Democrats arguing a GOP president has taken his eyes off the middle-class economic issues that drive voters to the polls, giving their party a big opportunity. Emanuel is also widely seen as a presidential hopeful, and he's been making the rounds recently, including at Politics and Eggs, a must-stop at St. Anselm's College New Hampshire Institute for Politics. He also made more than a dozen stops in South Carolina last week, where allies claim he was met with a positive response. He's headed to Nevada this week. As part of his recent tour, he has also sat down for interviews where he has offered advice for Democrats struggling to connect with voters. In an interview with Fox News Digital in late March, he urged Democrats to centralize and ground ourselves in middle-class values and to get to the core of what voters want. Don't get caught up in some cultural cul-de-sac that leads to nowhere, he said. In the interview on the Fifth Column, he also urged Democrats to take a different approach to the culture wars. We as Democrats nationally, from Latinx to defunding the police, to police organizations are all racist, to bringing a set of culture wars to our schools, he said. We are on the losing side of those culture wars, full stop. There are a number of skeptics in the Democratic Party who do not see Emanuel as a credible contender in 2028. It's a campaign and a movement that exists for people in the Acela Corridor green room, said Democratic strategist Eddie Vail, who also suggested that if Emanuel is running as a party outsider, it's an odd spot for a former Democratic congressman, White House chief of staff, and ambassador to Japan. Emanuel offering an outsider's critique of the party reminds me of when former House Speaker Paul Ryan said he loved listening to Rage Against the Machine, Vail said. Others say Emanuel is the kind of candidate who could win. They say he's well-connected inside and outside of the party apparatus and could fundraise better than most candidates because of his large network. He's also real for a politician, said one strategist who pointed to his well-known use of the F-bomb in casual conversation. Emanuel is well-versed on the internal workings of national campaigns and the federal government, and he isn't afraid of the vast media landscape, this strategist said. Another source in Emanuel's orbit said he is aware of the perception that he is part of the old guard of the party and the need for generational change. But those who have heard him on the road have responded to his straightforward approach, the source said, and not just on President Trump and the resistance, but his ideas on the future. He's focused on what comes next, the source said. And while Emanuel is very much the image of the Democratic establishment, some say he's not like the rest of the party's candidates. In this political environment, people are looking for someone different, said former Representative Steve Israel, Democrat of New York who served with Emanuel in the House. Rahm is connecting by demonstrating an ability to merge sharp political acumen with policy innovation. Israel said that while there's a long way to go before the primaries, Emanuel is getting impressive early attention, which is something to build on. Much of Emanuel's criticisms of his party seem to be pointed toward the progressive wing. Yet much has changed in the last 20 years, and it's unclear whether Emanuel would be in step with the majority of Democrats on various issues. For example, the party has clearly been moving away from the government of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and polls show younger Democrats in particular are increasingly critical of U.S. support for Israel in the Middle East. While Emanuel is a frequent critic of Netanyahu, he remains firmly aligned with a more traditional Democratic approach to the U.S.-Israel relationship. The tension could also extend beyond foreign policy. On healthcare, Emanuel has long been associated with a more incremental approach, even as parts of the electorate have pushed for more expansive reforms. His problem is the Democratic Socialists, who will not like what he says and will not be enthusiastic, said John Morgan, the Democratic Party mega-donor. A large part of the Democratic base is now socialist. Morgan, who said he loves Emanuel, said the former congressman and ambassador will also have problems because some Democrats didn't approve of Emanuel's time as Chicago mayor. But for me, when he speaks, I want to stand up and scream, hell yes, Morgan said in a text message. I just know if guys like me and Rahm have a place at that table, Rahm dishes out some strong medicine, but he is correct. Democratic strategist Basil Smickel said Emanuel brings the benefit of experience and a clear understanding of the party's past strengths and weaknesses, having spent years working within key institutions. However, for a younger generation of voters and activists, that history alone is not enough, Smickel said. He must demonstrate that his record is not a constraint on change, but a foundation for a new era of representation. The story, 5 takeaways from Trump's news conference on Iran. President Trump came to the lectern of the White House briefing room Monday for a lengthy news conference about the war on Iran. Trump, flanked by key allies, including Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, spent much of the first part of the event outlining how an airman who had been forced to eject from a fighter jet over Iran had been rescued. But inevitably, much of the attention in the jam-packed room and in the wider world focused on where the war goes next. The U.S. and Israel have hit more than 11,000 targets since they began their assault on February 28, but Tehran has proven defiant. Iran has also proven strategically adept at piling pressure on Trump by reducing shipping traffic in the Strait of Hormuz to a trickle, sending the price of oil and the price of gas at the pump soaring. Here are the big takeaways from Trump's Monday appearance. Mixed signals on what's next. Trump's propensity to give ambiguous and sometimes plain confusing messages on his strategy with respect to Iran is undimmed. At times on Monday, he sounded a very ominous tone. He described how the United States had a plan made possible by its military might, where every bridge in Iran will be decimated by 12 o'clock tomorrow night, while where every power plant in Iran will be out of business, burning, exploding, and never to be used again. I mean, complete demolition by 12 o'clock. But almost in the next breath, he suggested destruction on such a near-apocalyptic scale would be something he would prefer to avoid, in part because of the long-lasting economic damage that would result. We may even get involved with helping them rebuild their nation after the war. And you know what? If that's the case, the last thing we want to do is start with power plants, which are among the most expensive thing, and bridges, he said. A lot of haziness hangs over whether there is any realistic hope or a ceasefire. Never mind a permanent cessation of hostilities. We are dealing with them, Trump said of the Iranians, and it's going fine. The sliver of hope was accompanied by virtually no detail, however. Adding a final wrinkle of ambiguity, Trump was asked whether, if Iran wanted to meet his deadline, it needed to make a deal with the U.S. or reopen the Strait of Hormuz. His answer was, in essence, both. We have to have a deal that's acceptable to me, and part of that is going to be we want free traffic of oil and everything, he said. Trump brushes off suggestion of potential war crimes. The issue of potential war crimes has become far more acute as Trump has threatened to obliterate Iran's power plants and perhaps water desalination facilities. Attacks on civilian infrastructure are considered violations of the laws of war under the Geneva Conventions. For example, Article 52 of the Geneva Conventions asserts that attacks shall be limited strictly to military objectives. Insofar as objects are concerned, military objectives are limited to those objects which by their nature, location, purpose, or use makes an effective contribution to military action. Article 54 prohibits, among other things, attacks on drinking water installations and supplies and irrigation works for the specific purpose of denying them for their sustenance value to the civilian population. Trump shrugged off questions on the topic during Monday's news conference. When Zolan Cano Youngs of the New York Times pressed Trump on the issue, the president pivoted to an attack on the Times and addressed the substance of the question, only briefly saying he was not at all concerned about the possibility that some of his threatened attacks could amount to war crimes. To be clear, it is not obvious what sanction Trump would face, even in a hypothetical where war crimes were carried out. The U.S. is not a member of the International Criminal Court. Still, his brushing off of the question will further fuel alarm in the wider world, including among traditional U.S. allies. Trump threatens action over the news story on downed plane. Generalized attacks by Trump on the media are par for the course, but his jabs took an unexpected shape Monday when he complained vociferously about a story that had revealed the airman was missing after Iran downed an F-15E jet. Trump seemed particularly fixated on finding the person who had given the information to the media. We have to find that leaker because that's a sick person, he said at one point. He suggested the administration would pressure the media itself to give up the leaker's identity. The person that did the story will go to jail unless she or he identifies their source, he added. He also said, we're going to go to the media company that released it, and we're going to say, national security, give it up or go to jail. Trump did not specify the news organization nor the specific story to which he was referring. Fresh jabs at NATO and other traditional allies. Trump's grievance that traditional U.S. allies have not backed his efforts in Iran continues to fester. He is particularly exercised about what he considers a lack of support from other NATO members. He reiterated on Monday that he is very disappointed in NATO and asserted that the alliance's failure to directly joint the U.S. in Israeli war amounted to a dark mark on NATO that will never disappear in my mind. He once again derided the United Kingdom, in particular saying scornfully that in naval terms they have two old broken aircraft carriers that barely work. But Trump also broadened his target field on Monday, complaining with more vigor than previously that Australia, Japan, and South Korea had also failed to step up as he hoped they would. A U.S. toll on the Strait of Hormuz. One of the more peculiar moments of the news conference came toward its end when Trump was asked whether he was willing to end the conflict, even in a scenario where Iran could charge tolls on shipping traffic through the Strait of Hormuz. Us charging tolls, Trump asked. Iran, the reporter clarified. What about us charging tolls, Trump continued. I'd rather do that than let them have it. Why shouldn't we? We're the winner. We won, okay? The reality is that the de facto Iranian control over the strait is a major problem for the U.S. Of course, that situation could change, but right now the U.S. has clearly not won on the issue. The story, Pentagon canceled Tuesday's press briefing with Kane Hegseth. A scheduled press briefing set to take place at 8 a.m. on Tuesday at the Pentagon has been canceled. The briefing, which was to be conducted by Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, alongside Chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Dan Kane, was set to come just 12 hours before a deadline set by President Trump for Iran to reopen the Strait of Hormuz or face bombardment on power plant and bridge facilities. Tuesday will be power plant day and bridge day, all wrapped up in one. In Iran, Trump wrote on his Truth Social platform on Sunday, "Open the effing strait, you crazy bastards, or you'll be living in hell. Just watch, praise be to Allah, President Donald J. Trump." A reason for the cancellation of Tuesday's press briefing was not provided. The closure of the Strait of Hormuz, a major international shipping channel used to export oil from the Middle East, has destabilized global oil markets, as Iran has severely limited the traffic that can pass through. As a result, gas prices and other costs have skyrocketed over the past 6 weeks as the U.S. has been engaged in the conflict. Earlier Monday, Trump appeared alongside Hegseth and Kane during a White House press briefing on Iran, where they discussed objectives as well as the extraction of an American airman who had been forced to eject from a fighter jet over Iran and had to be rescued Sunday. Trump did not provide a clear message on what he would do if Iran did not meet that requirement imposed by his deadline, but he did talk about a possible plan where every bridge in Iran will be decimated by 12 o'clock tomorrow night, where every power plant in Iran will be out of business, burning, exploding, and never to be used again. I mean complete demolition by 12 o'clock. The story, what to know about Tuesday's elections in Wisconsin, Georgia. Voters in Wisconsin and Northwest Georgia will head to the polls on Tuesday to weigh in on contests that could offer insights into the political winds in two key swing states heading into the 2026 midterms. In the Badger state, voters will pick a new state Supreme Court justice, possibly expanding the court's liberal majority in an election that comes a year after tech billionaire and former Trump administration official Elon Musk's failed high-profile effort to add a conservative to the court. Meanwhile, in Georgia, a special election runoff will decide who replaces former Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia, 3 months after she left Washington amid a feud with President Trump. Here's what to know about Tuesday's races. Trump keeps distance in Wisconsin's Supreme Court race. Trump has notably stayed mum on Tuesday's Wisconsin Supreme Court race, where the Democratic-backed candidate Chris Taylor is competing against conservative Maria Lazar for an open seat on the high court. The race has drawn notably less attention than last year's election for another seat on the state Supreme Court, largely because this year's race won't impact which faction controls the majority. Liberals currently enjoy a 4-3 edge on the Badger State's High Court. However, if Taylor wins Tuesday's election, that lead would expand to 5-2. Trump's decision not to endorse Lazar marks a departure from his 2025 stance. Trump, as well as Musk, were deeply involved in Wisconsin's judicial race, which broke spending records. The president's move, however, may be rooted in his rising unpopularity in the state, where he sees low approval ratings. A Marquette Law School poll released last month showed Trump at a 42% approval rating and 56% disapproval rating in the state. The polling is a far cry from February 2025, when a similar survey showed the president at a 48% approval rating and 51% disapproval rating. GOP likely to cushion slim House majority in a Georgia contest. A Tuesday runoff in Georgia will decide who replaces Green in the Peach State's 14th congressional district, a race that is likely to bolster House Republicans' slim majority in Congress. Republican Clay Fuller is squaring off against Democrat Sean Harris, who ran against Green in 2024 and lost by roughly 30 points. The special election shifted to a runoff after neither candidate notched the majority they needed to win outright in March. Harris has led the fundraising race and notched support from the likes of Senator Raphael Warnock, Democrat of Georgia, and former Transportation Secretary and possible 2028 presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg. He won the most votes in the initial March 10 contest, but Republican candidates outnumbered Democrats and splintered voter support. Trump has thrown his weight behind Fuller, and the chances of a Democratic flip are ultimately a long shot in a district the president won by around 37 percentage points in his 2024 White House bid, according to the down ballot. More than a dozen candidates sought to replace Green, a longtime Make America Great Again stalwart, who broke with Trump ahead of her dramatic exit from Capitol Hill last year. The controversial former congresswoman has stayed out of the race even as her firebrand persona looms large. Barring a long-shot Harris victory, Fuller's likely win will help the GOP cushion its majority in the lower chamber as the party seeks to hold on to its edge in the 2026 midterm elections. Both Harris and Fuller are vying for their party's nomination in Georgia's May 16 primary for a full term in the seat. Wisconsin Democrats expected to notch another judicial win. Liberals are favored to win Tuesday's election in the Badger State, expanding their majority on the state Supreme Court. Taylor, the liberal candidate, has a clear fundraising and polling edge over her GOP-backed opponent, Lazar. The last time a conservative candidate notched a seat on the high court was 2019, with Democratic-backed candidates successfully securing a majority with three victories since then. As Wisconsin Democrats prepare for a likely victory, some Republican operatives have criticized Lazar's candidacy, arguing she's done a little to appeal to the GOP base. Taylor's campaign has done a very effective job of inserting issues that matter to progressive voters, chief among them abortion, and making the case that that is on the line Tuesday without necessarily calling themselves a Democrat or a liberal. One Wisconsin GOP operative who's run statewide races told The Hill ahead of the race. Yet the race has also underscored some of the GOP's overarching woes in Wisconsin, as the state party has struggled to compete with Democratic fundraising and field operations. Wisconsin GOP Chair Brian Schimming, however, has dismissed those concerns, noting that Republicans hold the majority in both state legislative chambers and control two competitive House districts. Sometimes when people lose, they look for places to blame, he told The Hill. Contest to gauge voter enthusiasm in key swing states. Tuesday's elections offer a preview of voter enthusiasm in two key swing states as the midterm season heats up. In both the Georgia special runoff and the Wisconsin Supreme Court contest, the winners will head right to their new seats, but they come ahead of critical primaries in both states that could tee up major contests for the midterms this fall. Next month, Georgians will vote in primaries in a toss-up Senate race as Republicans vie to oust incumbent Senator John Ossoff, Democrat of Georgia, in a state Trump won by 2 points in 2024. And candidates have crowded in on both sides of the aisle in the race for governor. Incumbent Governor Brian Kemp, Republican, is term limited and cannot seek re-election. In August, Wisconsin voters will also weigh in on a toss-up race for governor after incumbent Governor Tony Evers, Democrat, decided against a re-election bid, and Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District, where Representative Derek Van Orden, Republican of Wisconsin, is running to hang on to his seat, is one of fewer than two dozen House seats rated as 2026 toss-ups by Cook Political Report. As Democrats celebrate a string of off-year and special election wins, this week's Georgia and Wisconsin races could provide clues on where voter enthusiasm and Democrats' momentum stand months out from the midterms as they aim to flip key seats this fall. The story is The Hill's Morning Report, Iran defiant as Trump's deadline day arrives. In today's issue, Trump's Iran deadline day, Wisconsin Supreme Court race, midterm planning heats up, Vance visits Hungary. Iran is showing no sign of backing down as President Trump's deadline for Tehran to reopen the Strait of Hormuz is hours away, poising the commander-in-chief to either follow through on a major escalation of the war or once again push back his ultimatum. The Iran Foreign Ministry said Monday that it officially rejects the U.S.'s proposed 15-point peace plan to end the conflict, calling it unrealistic. Iran firmly refuses any negotiations conducted under the shadow of illegal sanctions, military threats, or coercion, the Iranian government said in a post on the social platform X, adding diplomacy requires mutual respect, not pressure. Trump told reporters Monday that Iran's latest offer was significant, offer but not good enough to avoid attacks on its power plants and bridges. During a press briefing in the White House later in the day, the president doubled down on his deadline at 8 p.m. today for Iran to make a deal with the U.S. The entire country could be taken out in one night, and that night might be tomorrow night, Trump said at a press conference Monday. It's not clear if reopening the strait on its own would be enough for Trump. Axios's Barak Ravid reported Trump also told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu he would insist Iran hand over its enriched uranium and pledge not to resume enrichment. The president has already delayed his deadline for Iran to reopen the waterway twice. He brushed off concerns that striking the power plants and bridges would constitute war crimes, as critics have argued. No, not at all, he said in a response to a question about whether he was concerned the strikes amount to war crimes. Trump said the majority of Iranian people want the U.S. to keep bombing, claiming that they're willing to suffer the destruction of their power plants and energy infrastructure to gain freedom. He added that Iran is still negotiating and that the U.S. believes it is doing so in good faith, but we're going to find out. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and General Dan Kane, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, were scheduled to deliver a press briefing this morning at 8 a.m., 12 hours before the deadline, but the briefing was canceled hours after being announced without explanation. The U.S. and Iran have reportedly received a draft peace proposal sent by mediators from Egypt, Pakistan, and Turkey to establish a 45-day ceasefire. It would include a full reopening of the Strait of Hormuz. But Iranian state media reported that Iran is insisting on a permanent end to the hostilities and delivered its own 10-point proposal, which includes a guarantee that Iran not be attacked again, an end to Israeli strikes against Hezbollah, and lifting of all sanctions. Pakistan's positive and productive endeavors in goodwill and good office to stop the war is approaching a critical sensitive stage, Iran's ambassador to Pakistan wrote Tuesday morning on X. Stay tuned for more. Five things to know today. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick will testify before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee in a transcribed interview scheduled for May 6. Lutnick's agreement follows accusations that he misled the public about his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. The United Kingdom is hosting a virtual meeting today from more than 40 countries to discuss securing a reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, which won't include the U.S. The New York Times reports the meeting is mostly focused on steps that could be taken after fighting between the U.S. and Iran ends. The Artemis II crew is on their way back home after completing a flyby of the moon and traveling the furthest humans have ever gone from Earth. The journey back will take a few days and is scheduled to be completed Friday. Leading the day to the polls, voters are heading to the polls in Battleground, Wisconsin today for a state Supreme Court race that could extend liberal control of the court for years to come. Wisconsin Appeals Court Judge Chris Taylor, who is backed by Democrats, is favored heading into the election day against conservative State Appeals Court Judge Maria Lazar, who is supported by Republicans. The race for retiring conservative Justice Rebecca Bradley's seat is officially nonpartisan, but has in effect been a partisan battle, as has been typical for court races in the state. Liberals currently hold a 4-3 majority on the court, but they're eyeing a pickup opportunity that would expand it to a 5-2 advantage. The race has drawn considerably less attention than the contest for an open seat last year, as that election determined who would hold a majority. The president has also stayed out of the race, holding off from endorsing Lazar, unlike last year when he was deeply involved in promoting the conservative candidate. Billionaire Elon Musk also poured millions of dollars into last year's race to back the conservative and unsuccessful effort that he is not replicating this time. But the race is still considered critical, as a win by Taylor could ensure liberal control of the court through the remainder of the decade, and limited polling points to Taylor holding the edge. Taylor's campaign has also outraised her opponent by a roughly 5-1 margin. Some Republican operatives have criticized Lazar's campaign for not doing enough to appeal to the GOP base, the Hill's Caroline Vakil reports. Political observers will be looking to the outcome of the race as another indicator of what may be to come for the midterms. Meanwhile, voters in Georgia's 14th congressional district are also heading to the polls in a runoff to fill that seat vacated by former Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia. Republican Clay Fuller is favored to win in the deeply red district against Democrat Sean Harris, but Democrats will be hoping to improve on their 2024 performance as another sign of boosted momentum heading into November. On your marks, big spending on the midterm election cycle is quickly getting underway as two major campaign groups are revealing some of their plans. The Senate Leadership Fund, a super PAC, associated with Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, that works to elect Republicans to the Senate, announced a whopping $342 million investment across 8 states in its largest ever ad buy. The group is making a push to go on offense for key seats in Michigan, Georgia, and New Hampshire, while defending GOP-held seats in Ohio, North Carolina, Maine, Iowa, and Alaska. The largest ad buy amounts are $79 million in Ohio, where Senator John Husted, Republican, is seeking to fend off a challenge from former Senator Sherrod Brown, Democrat, and $71 million in North Carolina, as former Republican National Committee Chair Michael Whatley faces former Governor Roy Cooper, Democrat. Republicans are seeking to defend their 53-47 majority in the upper chamber as Democrats hope to win back control. A Democratic group responsible for growing the party's majorities in state legislatures announced its first slate of target candidates Monday. The Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee said it would back candidates in key local races in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, North Carolina, Arizona, Georgia, Texas, and Iowa. The group said it plans to get involved in at least 500 races, including 300 for Republican-held seats. The announcement comes after a string of victories for Democrats in state legislative races, outperforming their 2024 results. Election Day is less than 7 months away. Democrats are favored to take the House and expressing increasing optimism about winning Senate control as Trump's approval ratings sink and economic anxiety rises. Path cleared, Trump ally Steve Bannon appears set to have his conviction for contempt of Congress thrown out after the U.S. Supreme Court sent the case back to a lower court judge who is expected to dismiss it. The justices declined Tuesday to hear arguments in Bannon's appeal of his 2022 conviction for refusing to follow a subpoena from a House committee that investigated the January 6, 2021 Capitol attack. The court instead granted his petition to vacate a lower court's holding and sent it back for review. The conviction will likely be erased there, as the Department of Justice, or DOJ, moved in February to dismiss the two-count indictment against Bannon that was filed nearly 5 years ago. A federal jury in Washington, D.C. found Bannon guilty on both counts for failing to appear for a deposition before the committees and refusing to hand over subpoenaed documents. Bannon was sentenced to 4 months in prison and served his time during 2024. White House trade advisor Peter Navarro also served a four-month sentence for his conviction on the same charges as Bannon's. Navarro is still appealing the case, though the DOJ has said it won't defend the conviction. Where and when? The president will participate in executive time at 8 a.m. He will participate in a policy meeting at 4 p.m. He will have dinner with the U.S. ambassador to India, Sergio Gore, at 7 p.m. The House and Senate are out today. Zoom in. Free advice. After spending years helping mold the modern Democratic Party, Rahm Emanuel is arguing that it isn't working. The Hill's Amy Parnes reports Emanuel, who served as White House Chief of Staff to former President Obama, has become one of the party's sharpest internal critics, as speculation has swirled that he's eyeing a 2028 presidential bid. Emanuel has argued that Democrats have lost their way on a range of topics, from economic messaging to cultural issues. Every one of our most successful electoral presidents anchored themselves in what I call middle-class values, and values that are universal, at least in this country, ascribed to. We went from acceptance to advocacy, Emanuel said last month on a podcast. Emanuel was at the center of Democrats' efforts to regain control of the House in 2006, as the chair of the House Democrats' campaign arm, recruiting centrist candidates to run in purple districts. 2 decades later, Democrats are once again arguing a Republican president has been distracted by a war in the Middle East and drawn away from economic issues affecting the middle class. Parnes reports Emanuel has been offering advice to Democrats who are struggling to connect with voters as he travels to a few key early voting states in the Democratic presidential nominating process. He told Fox News Digital last month that Democrats must ground ourselves in middle-class values and get to the core of what voters want. But some Democrats are skeptical as to whether Emanuel can be a serious contender for the nomination in 2028 if he runs, while others say he is the kind of candidate who can win, Parnes reports. Elsewhere, Vance visit. Vice President Vance will visit Hungary on Tuesday and Wednesday, just days before a key Trump ally, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, faces a tough re-election bid. Vance will hold a bilateral meeting with Orban and speak on the U.S.-Hungarian relationship, but the timing of the meeting is noteworthy as the Prime Minister is trying to survive the most significant challenge to his leadership since he came back to power more than 15 years ago. Polls show a close race between Orban's party and the opposition, raising huge questions about the country's future ahead of the vote Sunday. Orban has been a dominating force in Hungarian politics for decades. He served a 4-year term as prime minister at the turn of the century before his party lost power, but it came back to power in 2010, and he has held the prime minister's office since then. Since Trump's first rise to the presidency, Orban has been a key ally as a far-right standard bearer in the European Union. Trump endorsed Orban in a social media post last month, as he did in 2020 and 2022. He fights tirelessly for and loves his great country and people, just like I do for the United States of America, Trump wrote. Viktor works hard to protect Hungary, grow the economy, create jobs, promote trade, stop illegal immigration, and ensure law and order. Soldier's wife. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, officers have reportedly arrested the wife of a U.S. Army staff sergeant at the military base where he is stationed. ABC News reported ICE officers detained 22-year-old Annie Ramos just days after she married 23-year-old Matthew Blank. Relatives were present at the military base in Fort Polk, Louisiana, to help Ramos get registered as a military spouse and move in before the arrest. An attorney representing the family told ABC that Ramos was born in Honduras and was just 20 months old when she was issued an order of removal. Relatives of military service members are often eligible for various forms of relief, but Ramos is being detained through enforcement of that order. Ramos is also eligible for deferred action for childhood arrivals, which grants protections to those brought to the U.S. as children, but the program is paused for new applicants. She has no legal status to be in this country and was issued a final order of removal by a judge. The administration is not going to ignore the rule of law, a spokesperson for the Department of Homeland Security told ABC. I never imagined that trying to do the right thing, registering my wife so she could receive her military ID, access the benefits she is entitled to as my spouse, and begin the process toward her green card would lead to her being taken away from me, Blank said in a statement. Instead of preparing for our future together, I am now fighting for her freedom. And finally, the University of Michigan reigns supreme. University of Connecticut stayed within striking distance from much of the NCAA March Madness final on Tuesday, but the Wolverines rolled to victory. Michigan defeated UConn 69-63 to win its second ever title in the men's tournament, its first since 1989. The Wolverines became the first team in the tournament's history to score at least 90 points in five consecutive games. But it was solid defense and a near-perfect free-throw percentage that clinched the victory Tuesday. Michigan's win follows a triumph from the University of California, Los Angeles. In the women's tournament on Monday, UCLA defeated the University of South Carolina in a commanding 79-51 win to claim its first women's March Madness title. The story, Samsung to discontinue its messaging app. Samsung Messages will be discontinued in July, according to an end-of-service announcement published on the company's U.S. support website. Impacted owners of Samsung smartphones and other gadgets are being asked to switch to Google Messages in the meantime to maintain a consistent messaging experience on Android. All Samsung Galaxy phones run on Google's Android operating system. To switch to Google Messages, Samsung's website gives users instructions to download the app from the Play Store, if not already on their phone, and set it as the default. Some people may also receive an in-app notification to guide them through the process. Users of older Android operating systems dating back to Android 11 or older will not be impacted by the end of Samsung Messages, the company noted. To check what Android OS you have on a Samsung device, open the Settings app, click on Software Information, and scroll to Android Version. Meanwhile, owners of Samsung's latest Galaxy 26 lineup and other newer phones cannot download the Samsung Messages app from the Galaxy Store today. All devices will no longer be able to download Samsung Messages after it's officially discontinued in July, the company noted. Samsung said users can check their app for the exact date for when service will go offline. The story, Queen Elizabeth II was irritated over Tiaragate incident with Meghan Markle book. Queen Elizabeth II wasn't happy about a wedding tiara incident with Meghan Markle, according to a royal biographer in Robert Hardman's new book, Elizabeth II in Private in Public, The Inside Story. He claims that the Queen invited Meghan to a Buckingham Palace to select a tiara from her personal collection to wear at her wedding with Prince Harry. The act was customary for the Queen and royal brides, Hardman wrote, according to the Daily Mail's excerpt of the book. Elizabeth would pick out a small selection which she thought would suit the bride and ask her round to try them on and choose one, he wrote, describing it as her lovely way of bonding with the bride. However, things turned when Prince Harry tagged along for the tiara selection, a noticeable difference from how Harry described the moment in his memoir, Spare, where he wrote that he was invited. Tensions grew following the meeting when the couple reportedly requested that the tiara, Queen Mary's diamond bandeau, be sent over so Meghan could practice trying it on, Hardman said. He added in what he dubbed Tiara Gate that the request upset not only Queen Elizabeth but her dresser and curator, Angela Kelly. The Queen reportedly said, according to one of her aides, "It's not a toy," the author wrote. The story: CBS announces what's taking over Colbert's Late Show time slot. Byron Allen's Comics Unleashed is officially moving into the Late Show's time slot when the Stephen Colbert-hosted series takes its final bow on CBS next month. The comedy-centric show, hosted by media mogul Allen, will debut in the 11:35 p.m. time slot beginning May 22nd, CBS announced Monday. The network said it would air back-to-back half-hour Comics Unleashed episodes on weekdays. The change comes after CBS, in a stunning move last July, announced it was ending The Late Show this year. "This is a purely financial decision against a challenging backdrop in late night. It is not related in any way to the show's performance, content, or other matters happening at Paramount," CBS said in a statement at the time. Colbert, who has helmed The Late Show since 2015 after taking the reins from longtime host David Letterman, is known for being one of President Trump's most vocal critics in late-night TV. His final show is poised to air on May 21. As part of the arrangement, Allen pays CBS to lease the late-night time slot. The benefit for CBS, ITK hears, is that the network will generate profit as part of the time buy agreement, which covers the 2026-2027 TV season. The Allen Media Group CEO had previously been airing Comics Unleashed on CBS in the 12:37 p.m. spot. Another Allen show, Funny You Should Ask, will air in that time slot following Colbert's exit. "I created and launched Comics Unleashed 20 years ago so my fellow comedians could have a platform to do what we all love, make people laugh," Allen said in a statement. "I truly appreciate CBS's confidence in me by picking up our two-hour comedy block of Comics Unleashed and Funny You Should Ask, because the world can never have enough laughter," Allen said. The story: yes, the moon rotates, so why don't we ever see the far side? With Artemis II's historic mission to the moon capturing the nation's attention, some may be wondering why the far side of the moon remains hidden from view even as it rotates. Also commonly referred to as the dark side of the moon, as any fan of Pink Floyd's music would tell you, the side hidden from Earth's residents isn't actually any darker. The moon, like Earth, has a light side and a dark side, which changes as the moon rotates. So why does one half never face Earth? The same side of the moon always faces an Earth-bound observer, because the moon's orbital period is the same as its rotation around its axis, NASA explains. Simply put, the moon is rotating at the same speed that it rotates around the Earth, so the same side continually faces our planet. While the far side of the moon was first captured in 1959 by the Soviet Luna 3 spacecraft, the astronauts aboard Artemis II made history Monday when they became the first to see certain parts of the lunar surface with the naked eye. Artemis II breaks a distance record Monday, less than an hour before kicking off the fly-around and intense lunar observations on Monday. The four Artemis II astronauts, three Americans and one Canadian, surpassed the distance record of 248,655 miles, or 400,171 kilometers, set by Apollo 13 in April 1970. They kept going, hurtling ever farther from Earth. Before it was all over, Mission Control expected Artemis II to beat the old record by more than 4,101 miles, or 6,600 kilometers. "It is blowing my mind what you can see with the naked eye from the moon right now. It is just unbelievable," Canadian astronaut Jeremy Hansen radioed ahead of the flyby. He challenged this generation and the next to make sure this record is not long-lived. Artemis II is using the same maneuver that Apollo 13 did after its "Houston, we've had a problem" oxygen tank explosion wiped out any hope of a moon landing. known as a free return lunar trajectory. This no stopping to land route takes advantage of Earth and the moon's gravity, reducing the need for fuel. It's a celestial figure eight that will put the astronauts on course for home once they emerge from behind the moon Monday evening. The story, NASA's Artemis II mission sets stage for 2028 moon landing. Four astronauts went further from Earth on Monday than anyone ever before. We most importantly choose this moment to challenge this generation and the next to make sure this record is not long-lived, Artemis II commander Reid Wiseman said. Wiseman, pilot Victor Glover, mission specialist Christina Koch, and Canadian Space Agency mission specialist Jeremy Hansen made history Monday. They surpassed the 248,655-mile distance from Earth, record set by Apollo 13 in 1970. It's part of Artemis II, the first manned moon mission in more than 50 years. "We are having a blast up here, and the view of the moon is absolutely amazing," Wiseman said. The commander also sent a message to his daughters back on Earth, making a heart shape with his hands, and proposed naming a crater after his late wife. "It's a bright spot on the moon, and we would like to call it Carol," he said. The flight sets the stage for NASA's plans to put two astronauts on the moon in 2028. Crew members photographed and recorded observations of parts of the far side of the moon, never before seen by human eye. All of it was live-streamed by NASA. I, and hopefully many other space fans out there, will have their Pink Floyd album on, because we're going to be looking at the dark side of the moon, the Planetary Society board member Dr. Newton Campbell Jr. said. Campbell says this mission is all in preparation for the next moon landing. Artemis II is really the test flight, going around the moon and doing some great science while we're making that trip, Campbell said. The crew is taking a figure-eight course through space with a splashdown in the Pacific on Friday. The story of why you can't see any stars in photos from Artemis II. Looking up into the night sky, you're bound to see the moon and stars, and maybe a planet or some satellites. The photos being shared by the crew of Artemis II, however, haven't shown you all of that. The astronauts within the Orion capsule have shared photos of Earth and the moon, giving us Earthlings insights into what they're seeing on their historic lunar flyaround. That includes shots of the Oriental Basin as part of the moon that the human eyes have never seen in its entirety, taken by Nikon cameras. They also have iPhone 17 Pro Maxes on board for photos and videos. What you won't see in the pictures are any stars. It's primarily because the stars are pretty dim and camera settings are keeping them at bay. To capture them, the cameras of the Artemis crew would need to have a higher shutter speed and low light sensitivity. Another reason the crew isn't trying to take photos of the stars. In addition to unseen parts of the backside of the moon, NASA officials say they'll be able to view Mercury, Venus, Mars, and Saturn, as well as the solar corona, when the sun passes behind the moon in an eclipse. Even though the photos coming in from space have black backgrounds, they're being taken in periods of direct sunlight. The sun is shining on the spacecraft or the moon, making it quite bright. The camera's exposure settings have to be adjusted for that brightness, meaning the faraway dim stars remain invisible, astrophotographer Andrew McCarthy told Reuters in 2022 during the Artemis 1 mission.